My first week here, I redecorated the minister's study. I took out many of the things that were there. There was an old 19th century photograph of an old guy with significant mutton chops, far in excess to anything Neil Young dreamed about in the late 60s. It was that photograph right there. I put it in a drawer. I displayed photos of my wife and daughter, two cats, two dogs, the sheet music to Take Me Out to the Ball Game, a copy of the cover of a music book called Play Guitar Like the Beatles, my divinity school degree, and various religious tchotchkes, including a photograph of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X together. After I found out who the old guy with the mutton chops was, I took out his photograph and placed it next to Malcolm and Martin. In a way, that's all you need to know about Francis George Shaw. But wait, there's more. Samuel Shaw, Frank Shaw's grandfather, was an aide-de-camp in the Revolutionary War to General Henry Knox, who was the chief artillery officer of the Continental Army and later became the United States' first Secretary of War. As a result of this high placement, Samuel Shaw became an agent for several prominent New York and Boston businessmen who were on the first American ship to visit China. He reported back to the first United States Secretary of State, John Jay. Samuel Shaw, Francis Shaw's grandfather, practically invented the China trade in the United States. He made a lot of money. Because of his many voyages, he also became acquainted with the slave trade, and he came to hate it. Francis George Shaw inherited both his grandfather's money and his hatred for slavery. His grandfather's business partner was named Robert Gould, and Frank Shaw's father's name was Robert Gould Shaw. He was named after the business partner. Robert Gould Shaw took it upon himself to take the large fortune that he inherited and make it considerably larger. He became one of the richest men in America. And in 1809, Francis George Shaw was born. It was said that this young man was generous to those around him and possessed the tender heart of a woman. He was very tender-hearted toward man and beast. Frank Shaw remembered his father as a strict disciplinarian, but also a tender and loving parent. His most remarkable quality as a father might have been his insistence that his children form their own convictions. This is rare in any time of history. It was especially rare in early 19th century America, except in the Unitarian Church. The family attended the Unitarian North Church in Boston. His family also, which was not unusual for Unitarians and Universalists at the time, also were interested in spiritualism, that form of Christianity which believes that the spirits of people, when they die, become yet accessible through mediums and channels and trances and seances and so forth. Someday I'll do a sermon on Unitarian and Universalist involvement in spiritualism in this time. Frank Shaw's father worked relentlessly to increase his wealth. He diversified it considerably into real estate and mining and other kinds of wealth. This his son resented. For while his father was building a material legacy for future generations, he was leaving his current family without his presence. Frank Shaw never forgot this, this absent father, this rich absent father that he had. Frank Shaw married Sarah Sturgis in 1835. They were half first cousins. It always amazes me that the richest and poorest people in a society tend to marry their cousins. He tried working with the family firm as a young man. He found it abhorrent. He found both the people that he worked with and the people that worked for him tended to be greedy, unethical, tolerant of slavery and child labor, and he became to believe that all commerce played into the worst of human cravings. He also found the Unitarian Church increasingly stifling. To get away from both business and Unitarianism, the young family in 1840 moved to West Roxbury, which at the time was rural. He left his father's firm and joined the Unitarian Church there. The minister was Theodore Parker. If you have not already, you may become weary of hearing me talk about Theodore Parker. He was the transcendentalist abolitionist who kept his pistol in the drawer. His church was a stop on the Underground Railroad. He supported John Brown. He physically confronted slave owners. The Shaws embraced this new radical movement of transcendentalism. Emerson and Margaret Fuller were not merely influences upon George Shaw, Frank Shaw. They were his friends. He was a cousin to James Russell Lowell, who wrote the lyrics to Once to Every Soul and Nation. He was friends with Elizabeth and Robert Browning. Shaw also embraced a new socio-political movement called Association. It was basically what we today would call socialism. Yes, the son of one of the richest capitalists in America was a socialist. The Shaws lived almost next to Brook Farm, the transcendentalist experiment in socialist living. It didn't work for very long, but Frank Shaw was one of its major financial contributors. Shaw also was part of a minor scandal, becoming the first English person to translate from the French the novels of the scandalous George Sand. In 1846, he was elected treasurer of the American Unitarian Association. It was also the year his family moved to Staten Island. His wife suffered from failing vision. And as you may know, there was a Dr. Elliot, the first eye specialist in America, whose practice was on Staten Island. So they moved initially so she could get help with her vision, which she received, and her vision was saved. And they found it so hospitable that they moved here. His father's will left him a wealthy man in control of numerous investments in blatantly capitalistic enterprises. But Frank saw no contradiction between his belief in socialism and his management of a great share of the company's stocks and property after his father's death. His rationale is a familiar one, which my lack of wealth leaves me unfamiliar with personally. But he said that he could give away every penny, and yet there would still be poor. What he needed to do was not only be generous with what he had, but change the system. This was the one great remedy that became the title of his biography. He was forever looking for that one great remedy that would pull everything together, that would be a cure to the fallen nature of humanity's greed, that would cure inequality and injustice once and for all. Still, while he was in Staten Island, he traveled to Boston a few days every month on business. He did not devote his life to increasing his wealth, as his father did. And he was not an absent father, as his father was. His house his land, his mansion, was unbarred up about that way, maybe a half a mile at most off of Richmond Terrace. He had five servants that were all Irish. And if you read his wife Sarah's letters, you realize that while she was very pro-African American, she was a little anti-Irish. They joined the Unitarian Church here. Actually, there were two congregations that sort of merged and formed this one in 1852. I've been unable to find an actual list of the founders, but if he wasn't literally one of the founders, he was clearly one of the first. And in that biography, it also says, the Shaws were in the center of a small group in West New Brighton whose life was devoted to abolition. Mostly New Englanders by birth and Unitarian by faith, they lived in a city dominated by the Democratic Party, where pro-slavery sentiment was rampant. Their closest friends, the Gays, whose home was a stop on the Underground Railroad, encountered ridicule and harassment from their public friendship with prominent African-American middle-class families. And the single event that caused Sarah to be anti-Irish was the night that she hosted a freedman, a black freedman, in her house along with his family. And the Irish servants were totally appalled that they would have an African-American family that now they would have to serve. Their son, Robert Gould Shaw, affirmed his family values, but, and I think we can understand this if we are fathers and mothers, he affirmed them with rather less ardor than his parents. It is said that he wrote, because I don't talk and think of slavery all the time, and because I get tired of hearing of nothing else, you say I don't feel as you do when I do. Their older daughter, Anna, married George Curtis in 1856. George Curtis had spent two of his latter teenage years at Brook Farm. He was a writer, publisher, and orator. He was the editor of Harper's. This was at a time when one of the main ways of educating the country was through the Lyceum. People would go on the lecture circuit from town to town to town. Emerson was probably the most famous member of the Lyceum circuit at the time. But George Curtis was probably in the top 10, if not more than that. Unlike Emerson, he was also more broadly, his topics spanned a more broad spectrum of topics. He was a humorist and a satirist, as well as an essayist and an abolitionist. He was sort of literally like John Stewart today, or Bill Moyers. He was a famous man. Then came the Panic of 1857, well named, because it took place in 1857. It was also the year of the Dred Scott decision. And in fact, the Dred Scott decision was the cause of the Panic of 1857. The Dred Scott decision rendered the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. So now the fate of the Western lands was uncertain, which made the fate of the railroads moving west uncertain, which made the fate of the financial markets uncertain. There was a large bank in Ohio that was not too big to fail. And when it did, it contributed to the panic. Railroad futures were as uncertain in 1857 as petroleum futures will be if Baghdad falls. In the Panic of 1857, Francis George Shaw lost perhaps half of his income, which left him only still as one of the richest men in America, but half as much as he was in 1856. So this was also when Francis George Shaw was president of the board of this church. He was president from 1856 to 1859. And that's why all these rich people were worried about money and why they worried about paying their minister the last 50 bucks of his salary. In 1858, in October, the trustees were asked to consider the problem of, quote, the insufficiency of the society's receipts. Now, amongst the traditions we have been handed down, there are not only the transcendentalist values, but also the transcendentalist, that also the value of the insufficiency of the society's receipts. I hope in the years ahead we can retain those transcendentalist values and not the insufficiency of the society's receipts. 1858, as you may know, was also the year of the notorious burning of the quarantine hospital. The quarantine hospital was where largely but not entirely immigrants were sort of shuffled off to Staten Island. Yellow fever, at least, was rampant and could not be contained within the hospital. And one day, it burned down. Now, it's uncertain whether Francis George Shaw took place in the actual burning, but it is clear, and he is on record as a conspirator, and he spoke shortly thereafter in favor and support of the burning of Quarantine Hospital. Now, as the Civil War approached, Shaw convinced several industrialists to support the Union effort. Partially, this was because they believed in the cause. Partially, as you know, war is good business. But it also showed, I think, how Francis Shaw, in maintaining his position in a capitalist system in which he didn't believe in, actually, in a circuitous way, helped his deepest beliefs, because it did encourage the Union war effort industrially. Their son, Rob, enlisted right away into the 2nd Massachusetts Regiment. Now, many of us know the story that follows. He was transferred to leading the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, one of the first regiments of black soldiers. Now, I recently saw the movie Glory, and it's a really good movie. Doesn't mention Staten Island, though. Staten Island gets, frankly, screwed. Because it mentions that they came from Massachusetts, which they did, but it doesn't say that they were living to Staten Island at the time. All they would have had to have mentioned was that they lived on Staten, but they didn't, and I think that's unfair. There's an actor playing Frank Shaw briefly, and it shows that Robert Gould Shaw, as a young man, was not thrilled about the idea of leading black troops. It wasn't that he for his day, had, I think, a pretty good impression of African Americans. It wasn't as evolved as his parents, but for his time, it wasn't bad. But, gee, they wanted him to take a heck of a chance. You know, this had never been done before. And while Frank Shaw, the guy whose most militaristic act was transferring George Sand, thought it would be a good idea for his son to lead a revolution in military strategy. And it is written in his correspondence and also in the movie. It shows while he was leading the regiment how his opinion of the black soldiers grew, both as human beings, as men, and as soldiers. And this was at the time of the draft riots. And you know, the draft riots on Staten Island were at least as bad as they were in New York. On July 18th, 1863, at the Battle of Fort Wagner, Robert Gould Shaw was killed at age 23. He was thrown in a common grave with the rest of his regiment, which the Confederates thought would be the greatest insult. And his father wrote, "We can wish for no holier place than that in which he lives. He lies among his brave and devoted followers, nor wish for him better company." Now, when I was growing up and even in college studying the Civil War, I never heard anything about black troops. Did you? First time I was really aware of it was the first time I went to the Boston headquarters, up, which used to be until this year, 25 Beacon Street, right across from Boston Common. And it's right across the street from the big August St. Gaudens statue. And so I think I was going up there for one of my main interviews to get ministerial fellowship. And as my wont, I was there early. I went across the street, and here was this Civil War monument. I looked at it closely. There's a white guy leading. All the troops were black. And I said, wow. I really think that's the first time that I really knew or really understood that. And now, if you study the Civil War, increasingly so, it is understood what profound effect the black soldiers had in the Civil War. First of all, it may have turned the tide militarily, because it was right at the time when both sides had suffered so many casualties. And yet here was an influx of new soldiers, even more committed to the cause than those that had gone before. It turned the tide in many battles, and it also turned the tide sociologically. Many opinions about black men changed in the North when those who had come home and after fighting with them. Same thing happened in World War II. It's not a mistake that Jackie Robinson joined the Dodgers in 1947. Sarah wrote, "The change of feeling about the black colored race seems nothing short of miraculous." Now keep in mind, the Shaws intentionally and quite determinedly created their son's legacy. They used their literary contacts. They helped create the change of heart in America that won the Civil War. Their friend Emerson and their cousin James Russell Lowell wrote poems about their son in the day that poems made a difference. It's like today if Dylan or Springsteen had written a song about him. But in his biography, the historian writes, "In truth, Robert Gould Shaw died as much a martyr to the zealotry of his parents as to the cause of the black man." The youngest child, Josephine, married Charles Russell Lowell, a nephew of their cousin, James Russell Lowell. He was killed in battle in the Civil War less than a year later. She spent her entire rest of her life mourning him. Josephine later became devoted to the education of black people in the South, as did her father. He was appointed by President Lincoln to oversee the education of Southern black children in the South. And this was such a crushing failure that it did a lot toward crushing this man's spirit, because he found that the war that he so supported and the cause that he so supported, when he went down there and faced the reality, he realized that the cause had not been won and the war was not over. Later, Josephine became the first woman commissioner of the New York Board of Charities, and there is a fountain monument to her behind the New York Public Library. It's the first monument to a woman in New York City. The second daughter, Anna, was the wife of George Curtis. She was board president of this church from 1903 to 1919, which meant she worshiped in this space. She was president when the parish hall and the parsonage was built. And many Unitarian churches did not have a woman board president until the 1960s or 1970s, sometimes even later. So, in so many ways, we are not far removed from Francis George Shaw and his family at all. And the issues they devoted their lives to are all still present. Here's the kind of parents the Shaws were. Except around here, they are not well remembered. But they have three kids, and all three kids have public monuments. What could be better said about parenting? I'm sure if that family could see us now, and if their spiritualist tendencies are correct, who's to say they can't? They would be most pleased and dismayed at how much things have changed in this country and how much they have stayed the same. May you join with me in our closing hymn, number 156.